Welcome to the Judicial Council Center for Families, Children, and the Courts podcast series on juvenile law. Over the last several years, justice reform has gained momentum and implemented many institutional changes. One of those changes has to do with how we think about punishment, and it has brought an old concept to the forefront. Today we'll be talking to Azim Kamisa about restorative justice and how it helped him heal after he lost his son to gun violence. Thanks for listening.
You know, most of my frustration with the criminal justice system was the fact that I really did not have a voice.
This is Azim Kamisa.
I had no teeth. I mean, I could holler and scream. We wouldn't do any good because the process is not in my hands. The victims do not have a say. There's no justice. I mean, when you look at the criminal justice system, it's very broke.
My name is Mervyn Deganios, and I'm here to share Azim Kamisa's story, his journey to justice. It's the story of how a profound loss changed Azim Kamisa's worldview, how that view rippled out through a community, and how it might show the path to a powerful kind of justice, one that restores. I met Azim at his home in San Diego.
Hi, Azim.
He's tall, and even though he's now 69 years old, he has a head of dark, wavy hair.
It's audio, right?
Yeah.
This is the same two-story condo he lived in back in 1995, when Azim was working full-time as a successful, hard-charging international investment banker. That January 21, Azim arrived home late. He'd been abroad on business. He went to bed. When he got up the next morning, Azim went downstairs and found a business card and a note from the night before. A detective at the San Diego Police Department wanted him to call.
So I came down in my kitchen. I was in here. I picked up the phone and dialed the number on there. And she told me that I don't have very good news for you. Your son was shot and killed last night, and I said, that doesn't make sense. I didn't believe her. So I very quickly hung up on her. So my knee-jerk reaction is that it was mistaken identity. I have dark skin. A lot of Hispanic people live in San Diego, and I thought, I probably made a mistake.
Tariq, Azim's son, also lived in San Diego. He was 20, attending college locally. Azim was sure his son was fine. Tariq had just gotten engaged to his girlfriend, Jennifer. Tariq and Jennifer had recently started living together.
So I quickly called his home number, fully expecting him to pick up the phone. Of course, he didn't. She did. And she couldn't really say anything. She was just sobbing. And that's when it hit. And I was in my kitchen right here. I lost legs, strength in both of my legs, collapsed to the floor, hit my head against this refrigerator, curled up into a ball, and the pain was so excruciating that I don't have the words. It was like literally like a nuclear bomb that had gone off in my heart, and I was broken into millions of smithereens. And I remember that the pain was so unbearable that I had my first out-of-body experience. I left my body.
When he'd collected himself, Azim called his ex-wife, who lived in Vancouver, his daughter, extended family. He called his friends. Dan, an old friend, rushed over. Sitting at Azim's kitchen table, Dan tried to console Azim.
He looks at me and he says, Azim, whoever these kids are that killed Tariq, I hope they fry in hell.
Tariq was a part-time delivery man. The night before, he'd gone to deliver a pizza, not realizing that the address he'd been given was a fake. When Tariq tried delivering that pizza, several teen gang members confronted him at gunpoint, demanding that he hand it over. Tariq refused and got into his car to leave. The gang's leader was an 18-year-old. Just weeks before, he'd killed a homeless man in front of his fellow gang members. He gave the order to shoot. A 14-year-old, Tony Hicks, was holding the gun. Tony fired one shot through the car window. One bullet fired over a pizza. Azeem, back at home, sitting next to his friend Dan at the kitchen table, Dan started crying.
He says, if somebody killed Adam, which was his son, was 12 years old then, not only would I want the killer, I'd want the whole clan. And my answer to him was, I don't feel that way. I see that there are victims at both ends of the gun. And I don't feel that way.
Azeem did not want revenge. What good would that do to a 14-year-old, a child? What Azeem yearned for was justice. That Azeem didn't want vengeance, though, did not mean he and his family were not distraught. They were. And in their anguish, they leaned hard on their friends and their faith community. As Azeem tried to grapple with how to move forward, he kept returning over and over again to the same thought. He didn't want his son's death to be for nothing. It couldn't be for nothing. He had to do something. In the following months, Azeem started a foundation aimed at stopping youth violence. He named the foundation the Tariq Khamisa Foundation, after his son. Azeem raised a few $1,000s from friends, but he felt he needed more help. That's when Azeem took an extraordinary step, one that, to him, was a step towards making things right, changing his community for the better. He decided to reach out to the guardian of the boy who killed his son, Tony's grandfather, a man named Ples Felix.
Because I think the two of us together had experienced the same loss. My son had died, and his grandson he had lost to the criminal justice system. He was like a son to him and calls him daddy. That's Ples's only grandson that was born to his only daughter. I think that I saw that we were both suffering. And you want company when you suffer.
Azeem also figured that his message of nonviolence would be more powerful if he could convince Ples to work with him. So Azeem contacted the San Diego District Attorney and asked to arrange a meeting. In a cramped San Diego Public Defender's office, accompanied by a district attorney and a public defender, the father of a dead child and the grandfather of the boy who murdered him met. The men shook hands and sat down. It was an unlikely meeting. Azeem Khamisa was an American of Indian Persian descent, born in Kenya, educated in England. Ples Felix, on the other hand, was African American, born in Louisiana, who'd moved to South Los Angeles to escape segregation. Azeem was a suit and tie businessman. Ples was a Vietnam vet, a former Green Beret who, at the time, wore his hair in dreads down to his waist. Azeem is a Muslim. Ples is a Christian. But Azeem saw something he and Ples had in common, and he offered Ples an invitation.
I really see that we both lost a son. I just wondered if you would help join the foundation, because while I can't bring Tariq back from the dead, and you can't get Tony out of prison, we can at least make sure no other young people in our community end up dead like Tariq or end up in prison like Tony. That we can do. Will you help me? So he's, the first words out of his mouth was, he says, you know, he's a Baptist from the South. He says, ever since I found out that my grandson was responsible for the death of your son, I went into the prayer closet, praying that someday I get a chance to meet you. So thank you for reaching out to me, because I wanted to impart my condolences to you and your family for your loss. And of course, I'll help you.
Azeem and Ples walked out of the meeting with a new purpose. Together, they believed they could build something good out of their shared tragedy, something for their community. They believed they could save kids from Tariq and Tony's fate. Tariq was dead. His fate was sealed. But Tony's future, that was playing out in court. Tony was 14 when he shot Tariq. It was 1995, and California had, just weeks before the shooting, lowered the age at which minors could be tried as adults. It had dropped from 16 to 14 years old. Azeem was adamant that Tony should not be tried as an adult.
He was only 14, and I felt that the enemy wasn't the 14-year-old.
Azeem believed that Tony was a victim of a violent society, one that had driven this child to kill, a society that had failed to protect him. And the more Azeem learned about Tony's story, the more confident he became that Tony was a victim on the other side of the gun. Tony was born to teenage parents. He'd watched an uncle die in a shooting. He was sexually abused by a woman when he was 8 years old. Tragedy after tragedy. Tony was sent from Los Angeles down to San Diego to live with his strict grandfather. For a while, that worked. But then, Tony fell into the wrong crowd and joined a gang.
Yes, at that point, you know, I had empathy for him, and it kind of stemmed from the standpoint that if I had lived the same kind of life as he had, would I have made the same decision?
That radical empathy for the boy who made the decision to shoot his son, that empathy let Azeem see Tony not as a hardened criminal, but as a boy who needed healing. It's why Azeem asked the district attorney to not try Tony as an adult. The district attorney, though, did not see it that way. And neither did the sheriff, who told the Los Angeles Times, "There's a generation of young people who are incapable of feeling anything for anyone." After a month-long hearing, it was decided. Tony became the first 14-year-old to be tried as an adult in California. When it came to sentencing, though, Azeem did have more of a say in the process. He could testify at sentencing and make a recommendation. He could confront Tony in court. Because Tony was being treated as an adult, the judge would have only two options: a minimum of 25 years, either with the possibility of parole or without. To Azeem, that did not feel like justice. It felt like revenge. Tony would be paying his debt to society with long prison time, but it was a repayment Azeem didn't recognize or want. Why did you feel like that wasn't justice for you?
Because it's my son. You know, I had the biggest loss in this tragedy. I lost my only son. I should have had the bigger voice than the state of California. You know, I mean, when you think about it, what do they have in terms of what did they lose? You know, I felt that the biggest loss was suffered by not only me, but the Camisa family.
Azeem felt this menu of only two options was too harsh. But Azeem had no power to ask for an alternative sentence.
And I, at that stage, understood that really, that my hands were tied behind my back. There's nothing I could do. It's the law. I can't change the law.
In the end, Azeem couldn't bring himself to testify in court in front of Tony.
Why was that, is it?
I just didn't want to revisit. It was very painful. And I just didn't want to go through. And for what reason? Because it's not going to make any difference.
Even though Azeem didn't testify, he requested, through the district attorney, that the judge give Tony the possibility of parole. The judge granted Azeem's request. It wasn't the more lenient sentence Azeem wanted, but it was the best he could get. For over a year, Tony moved through the court system. Through it all, his grandfather and the public defender visited him regularly. Through them, Tony learned that Azeem had forgiven him and about the pain he'd caused Azeem's family. The next year, in 1996, something remarkable happened. Tony pled guilty. At sentencing, Tony, wearing a gray sweatshirt and seated next to his public defender, read a statement.
On January 21st, 1995, I shot and killed Tariq Camisa, a person I didn't even know, and who didn't do anything wrong to me. Promising that I would be a better person. I won't mess up. When I first came to the hall, I was mad at the DA and people in the hall for keeping me here. Now I'm just scared, mad at myself.
Azeem watched Tony's statement on TV.
I could feel the authenticity of his words. And you can see it comes very deep from his heart. He's actually crying.
I still don't know why I shot Tariq. I didn't really want to hurt him or anyone else. I'm sorry for the pain that I caused Tariq's father, Mr. Kamisa. I pray to God every day that Mr. Kamisa will forgive me for what I've done. I'm very sorry for what I've done. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak.
That was healing because I had forgiven him, but had never heard him ask for forgiveness.
To Azeem, Tony's words were proof that his forgiveness and his partnership with Pless were working. Tony was becoming a better person, and part of that process included admitting his actions by pleading guilty.
Part of the reason he did that, which he shared with me and his grandfather, that he didn't want to drag my family or his family through an ordeal of a trial. So I believe that my forgiveness changed him.
To Azeem, that change was Tony trying to find a way to make things as right as possible. That, for Azeem, was a step towards justice. What do you tell somebody who says, okay, that's just a special case. Azeem is a special case. He's not an angry person. But there's no way that that works possibly for right. people who are not Azeem.
Right. Well, what I say to them is that I was angry, but not so much at Tony. I was angry that we didn't do enough to make sure we don't lose so many kids. So I was really angry at the system. I'm still angry at the system. There's so much we can do.
Azeem harnesses his anger and uses it to find ways to create justice that go beyond retribution and punishment. In fact, from the beginning, Azeem had a grand vision for something more complex than revenge for his son's death. Something that could heal Azeem's family, Tony's family, and their community. But to get it, he'd have to find it on his own, outside the criminal justice system. What Azeem didn't know was that the kind of justice he'd stumbled onto had a name. Restorative justice, or RJ for short. It's been practiced in other cultures for thousands of years, but was first identified by academics in the 1970s. In fact, if you look closely at Azeem's story, it illustrates three radical pillars of restorative justice. First, the most complete justice happens when all the affected parties are part of the response, not just government officials. Azeem becomes most agitated when he talks about feeling disempowered, not having a voice in court, not having a say in Tony being tried as an adult, or the limited options in Tony's sentence. That's because Azeem, a victim, did not play a central role in the process. In fact, the current system is a penal system. It's primarily focused on the guilt or innocence of the charged person. The focus is not on healing the victim or the community. For Azeem and other practitioners of restorative justice, victims like Azeem and their communities would be recentered, be given a greater part in administering justice. Azeem believes that having a larger say would have alleviated some of his pain and frustration. The second pillar of RJ is that justice isn't just about punishing the offender. It's about making things as right as possible. Right now, when we say an offender has paid their debt to society, to whom is that debt paid? Does prison time actually make the victim and community whole? The current system tends to fall short for the victim, as Azeem points out.
Nobody ever came from the state system to see how they could help me deal with my loss. I found that in my community, if you like, in my faith.
In restorative justice, the victim, offender, and community would come together to not just mete out punishment, but to also try to figure out how things can be made as right as possible. Imagine if the justice system could offer a victim, an offender, and their community the chance to meet. If it offered an official chance for the three to discuss what they believed would be the best way for everyone to heal, to be made whole. As in Azeem's case, that could mean the victim hearing the offender express remorse, seeing the offender understand the pain that they've caused. It might, perhaps, include working together to find ways that the offender can make things right, directly to the victim and community. Finally, the last tenet of restorative justice is perhaps the most profound. It's something that Azeem wholeheartedly believes.
In every crime, I know this is a tall order, there's an opportunity to create a better society.
This is why Azeem approached Pless, Tony's grandfather, about working to end youth violence. They wanted to create a world where their community wouldn't suffer from the loss of another Tariq or Tony. And it's working. The Tariq Kamisa Foundation has won a number of national awards. Azeem and Pless have told their story of radical reconciliation to millions. It's powerful, sure, but it's constrained and limited. The work depends on a distraught father working from one city in the country. But it doesn't have to be. Studies show that when restorative justice programs are incorporated into the justice system, they reduce recidivism rates. That's because RJ offers offenders a path to reclaiming their full humanity. Azeem and other RJ advocates realize, though, that it may not be right for every offender. But the question is, why shouldn't it be an option? At the heart of restorative justice is this hard truth, that nearly all the offenders in the system will, at some point, return to the streets. They will be our neighbors. They will be part of our community, part of the society that we choose to build, for better or for worse. The question now is, what can judges and others who work in the criminal justice system do to incorporate restorative justice into their practices? The answer is a frustratingly lawyerly one. It depends. There's no one solution in our current legal framework that works in every courtroom. Every community and jurisdiction and county has different needs and different resources. That said, there are some things you can do. First, check your local jurisdiction for any restorative justice initiatives. The resources available differ from county to county. If there is an RJ program available, you have options. At a minimum, one might use discretion to incorporate restorative justice principles and programs into sentencing. Detention alone is not restorative, and an alternative might be shorter time at a facility paired with probation involving an RJ-centered approach to services. If you'd like to go a step further, one could pressure the system to treat diversion to RJ programs as the default. That could mean encouraging district attorneys to consider RJ programs pre-adjudication, or even making a commitment to RJ diversion programs as a judicial preference. If your jurisdiction does not have a restorative justice program, it is possible to create one. For example, there's a restorative justice program in San Francisco called Make It Right. There, youth offenders, before their cases are charged, are given the chance to meet with the victim and representatives from their community. Together, they find concrete ways the offender can fix the harm they've caused to the victim, community, and themselves. If the offender completes the agreement, the case isn't charged. The program is supported by the court and headed by the district attorney in collaboration with probation and the public defender. A judge issued orders for the release and protection of information to the parties involved, and issued orders to establish protections for the information that's shared in the victim-offender meetings. It's just one example of a program that a judge can initiate by, first, talking to the justice partners in their county. If you check with your local jurisdiction, there's a chance a pilot restorative justice program exists. If not, there may be dormant funding for you to start one. Second, you can attend a conference on restorative justice. RJ solutions must be specifically tailored to the local community, RJ conferences like the National Conference on Community and Restorative Justice are a great way to find the right program for your jurisdiction. It's also a place to find the support you'd need to initiate a program. Taking any of the above steps would put us closer to something Azeem would recognize as justice. Five years after his son's death, Azeem chose to meet Tony in person. Azeem made the long trip from San Diego to New Folsom Prison at the base of the Sierras just outside Sacramento. Surrounded by other prisoners and their families, Azeem shook Tony Hicks's hand for the first time. Azeem and Tony sat down at a coffee table. They talked about Tony's last moments with Azeem's son, Tariq.
He was remorseful, and even though I'd forgiven him, we talked about that.
Tony, now 19 years old, told Azeem about life in prison. During that conversation, Azeem learned a lot about Tony.
The most amazing part of that whole meeting was us locking eyeballs. And I'm looking to find a murderer in him, and I found another human being. I was able to touch his humanity.
That meeting changed Azeem's life.
When I left there, it was like a big albatross off my shoulder. It was like my stride was much more bouncier than the one I walked in with. The big piece of me meeting Tony was that I then knew that I'd completed my journey of forgiveness.
On his own, Azeem had met Tony, reconciled with him, and reclaimed his life.
I've healed. My family has healed. Tony has healed. And the community has healed. So we are a live example of what's possible. Now, I didn't do this with the help of the system. But if the system could get behind it and say, why can't we do it? And why can't we orchestrate a similar path for every victim, offender, and community? Right? That would make a better world.
Azeem's story shows us what's possible with restorative justice. Since Tony went to prison almost 23 years ago, and since meeting Azeem face-to-face, Tony's completed his GED. He's a voracious reader and is studying to be a child psychologist. Tony and Azeem write each other once a month. Tony even wrote the foreword to Azeem's latest book. In October 2018, Tony, for the first time, will be up for parole. Azeem will be there with him, hoping justice is served. He will ask that Tony be restored, released from prison, and allowed to return to society. And whenever Tony gets out, Azeem and the community will have a new life waiting for him. That's because Azeem will hire Tony to work with him as a mentor in the Tariq Kamisa Foundation.
My story is just one story. But there are many other Tonys, right, given the same circumstances, would have a similar kind of an impact. The example is there.
Since I last interviewed Azeem, Tony had his first parole hearing. Azeem was there. He made a statement along with his invited guest, Tony's grandfather, Ples Felix. Azeem is glad to report that the parole board granted Tony parole and that Tony will be joining the foundation. If you'd like to learn more about Azeem Kamisa and the Tariq Kamisa Foundation, and see pictures of Azeem, Ples, and Tony today, you can visit tkf.org. That's TKF as in Tariq Kamisa Foundation.org. This has been a production of the Judicial Council of California and me, Mervin Deganos. Music was by Chris Zabriskie and Kevin McLeod. Thanks for listening.